You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Michael Robert Caditz. I'm here with Brandon Brownlee.
Glad to be back for another episode where we discuss cultural evolution.
Let me preface my argument that I'm going to make today with this. Cultural evolution is really a cutting-edge exploration, as opposed to biological evolution, which is quite established. Darwinian evolution is quite well established, quite well critiqued, widely accepted, but not universally accepted, of course. Cultural evolution is a more recent field, and I would characterize it as more exploratory than biological evolution. Some contemporary theorists are making a formidable effort to analogize cultural evolution to biological evolution and to theorize about the various mechanisms that are in play that are in some way analogous, such that cultures evolve in somewhat an analogous way to how human biology evolves. And in the previous show that you alluded to, Brandon, I critiqued those analogies and was somewhat skeptical of some of those analogies. And I expressed some skepticism that cultural evolution can be analogized to biological evolution. And without going into too much detail on my previous theory and exploration and comparison between culture and biological, I wanted to express some new thinking and new research that I've done since that time, a month or 6 weeks ago. And so, admittedly, the theory which I'm going to propound today, I believe is quite novel, probably very controversial, will probably be poo-pooed by many, but I believe it's intellectually sound, and I'm sure that either you or others who might hear this or read the paper that I'm planning on writing about this may find some flaws in the logic. I welcome those objections. So this is as much an exploration of my theory that I'm planning on doing for this show and getting feedback from you, Brandon, as a sounding board. It's more that than it is a definitive claim. It may have merit. My claim is that cultural evolution simply does not exist. This sounds a little bit like the eliminative materialists, you know, or logical positivists who, you know, in some way, shape, or form claim that states of mind don't really exist or can't be studied or can't be talked about or can't be known. I'm sort of the eliminative materialist of the evolution debate. I'm going to make a logical argument why I believe that cultural evolution simply does not exist.
Right.
It's a non-entity.
The thing about this, and I wanted to ask before we got into the argument, whether you thought that the controversial thing about it was going to be the argument itself or the position, because the corollary of this is that since cultural evolution doesn't exist, it's not really a thing, this whole field is, it's not a legitimate pursuit.
I'm not sure I want to go so far as to criticize or negate the whole field. Who am I? I'm just some, you know, little guy in British Columbia. I mean, this is a field that, you know, world renowned, you know, theorists are working on at major universities. And I quoted some of them, cited some of them in the last show that we did about this. So I want to keep it very narrow, just to my own logical thought progression, which leads me to conclude that there is no such thing.
Okay.
I mean, can you study a non-existent thing? Sure. Can you talk about, now we're getting into linguistics, philosophy of language.
Yeah, that's true.
That's another intractable problem in philosophy, philosophy of language. Can you speak of non-existent things? So
yeah.
Can people study cultural evolution if it doesn't exist? I don't know. They can talk about it. So here's a little bit of background, which I need to lay down before I can get into the meat of my theory. I wanted to talk about two types of change, and also perhaps in a novel way, I'm going to utilize medieval philosophy, medieval concepts to do this, a little bit novel, I think. St. Thomas Aquinas talked about two types of causal chains. There are what he characterized as per accidens causal chains. Per accidens, A-C-C-I-D-E-N-S. A per accidens causal chain is a type of causal chain where once the chain is set into motion, the first cause is no longer required. An example would be that a grandson's existence is not dependent on the grandfather's continued existence. The grandfather can pass away, the father can pass away, but the offspring, the grandchild, the child, continues. The causal chain continues. That grandson can have offspring. Things happen in the world caused by that grandchild. I shouldn't say it doesn't matter, but the existence of the grandson and the grandfather and the grandfather's parents and their parents and their parents all the way back through the ancestral lineage is not required for the continued existence of the grandchild. Per accidents causal chain. That's one type of causal chain. The other type mentioned in medieval philosophy is a per se causal chain. Per se, S-E. That is the type of causal chain which, contrasted with the per accidents causal chain, does require the first cause to continue. Otherwise, the entire chain stops in its tracks. So an example of that would be a hand is moving a stick. The stick hits the rock. The rock moves a leaf. If the hand no longer is moving the stick, that being the first cause, then the entire chain stops and the leaf doesn't move anymore all the way down the line. Unless some other cause makes it move, right? Like wind or something. But that particular causal chain initiated by the hand stops. So that's a very different type of causal chain. Per accident versus per se. So bookmark those distinctions because they're going to be critical in my argument for why cultural evolution does not exist. So let's talk about biological change, the less disputed, more studied biological change. And let's talk about whether examples of biological change fit more the per accidents type of causal chain or fit more the type of per se causal chain. It turns out that there are examples of each when it comes to biological change. So I want to make a distinction between mere change and evolution. So what I'm calling biological change is any change to the biology. So there are examples of what I would call epiphemeral change, which are not evolutionary change. They're simply reactions to one-off events, after which the organism, a community, the people, return to their previous state, and there's no particular residual effect on future generations of the organism. it turns out that that type of one-off event change is not easy to find because of the interrelatedness of organisms and communities and how something that happens to affect the community will have a ripple effect on other organisms and then likely on future generations. But in theory, at least, there could be, let's say there could be an extreme weather phenomenon or a temporary exposure to a toxic substance. So let's say that causes stress or disease to particular members of a community. One could think of that as a one-off event when the toxic substance is gone or when the weather returns to normal, then there could be recovery. Now, you could argue that in some way it indirectly affects future generations because now, you know, there was no, regeneration during the time of that phenomenon. But let's say it was a short phenomenon and the effect on future generations was minimal.
Yeah. So let's say we have, it's a good example, a sort of toxic dump or something like that. And this is going to affect the offspring that are produced in this period. But once those offspring have been born and raised and are living their life, by that time, the toxic dump has been washed away or it has exited the environment. And so it really is not an adaptation per se. It's not, it is a reaction to an environmental change, but it doesn't affect the biological community as such. And for that reason, it's not an evolutionary change because it's not a sort of genetic continued response in a change of the species in response to the environment.
So that type of one-off change where the effects of that change, for the most part, at least in theory, cease once the initial cause or the initial stimulus ceases to exist, like the extreme weather. To the extent that there's no continued effect, that would be an example of what I defined earlier as a per se causal chain. As soon as the initial cause ceases, such as the hand holding the stick or moving the stick, then the entire causal chain stops. One-off events, to the extent they exist, are in theory per se causal chains in a biological community with biological organisms. But that's not evolution. That's change without evolution. There's no evolution. The reason there's no evolution is because the causal chain that was initiated by the one-off event was a per se causal chain. Per se causal chain is associated with change which is not evolutionary. Evolutionary implies something different. Evolutionary implies a per accidents causal chain. In biology, we're talking about the biological world now. What we think of as evolutionary change or Darwinian evolution, process of natural selection, is evolutionary precisely because it is a per accidents causal chain. Each new generation of a species, each new generation of humans, a priori, contains the aggregation of all previous genetic changes to that species through natural selection, for example. I'm not going to go and drill down in too much detail. There's other things besides natural selection, and there's various nuances around natural selection, but it's beyond the scope of this particular discussion. Let's just say, for the sake of simplification, that we're mainly talking about evolutionary change in the Darwinian sense through genetic evolution, which is a process of natural selection, although there's some dispute around exactly how that natural selection happens, whether it's directed or not directed and that kind of thing, whether it's in fact random or not. It's a whole nother interesting topic. But my argument here so far is that in the biological world, there are two types of causal chain. And what distinguishes one-off, non-evolutionary change or reaction is the fact that such a causal chain is a per se causal chain. When the initial stimulus ceases to exist, the causal chain ceases to exist. Whereas in evolutionary change, offspring are born with the physical and genetic characteristics that are the aggregation or the accumulation or the sum total or the evolutionary result of what happened through natural selection in all previous generations, traced back all the way to the beginning of the species or how the species might have evolved from other species and that kind of thing. So that's my argument so far. That is the distinction, precisely the distinction between non-evolutionary and evolutionary change in the biological world. If a child were born, an offspring were born, and did not automatically, without any effort on its part or anyone, you know, in that offspring's environment, without any effort or without any action, if that offspring was born with the specific characteristics of a previous generation, that would be evolutionary change. If that offspring were not born with such characteristics, and only after some input from the environment acquired such characteristics, that would not be evolutionary change. That would be a per se causal chain, because the stimulus which caused that characteristic or reaction or behavior or physical trait of the offspring, the initial cause would have to be there again. The hand would have to be moving the stick all over again, de novo, to have the effect on that offspring. It would be a per se causal chain. It would not be evolutionary. A genetic characteristic acquired by offspring is a per accidens causal chain. It is automatic, a priori in that offspring. No action is required. Genetically transmitted, evolution is in play. So that's my argument so far, that there is clear distinction between these two types of causal chain. One suggesting non-evolutionary biological reactions, perhaps one-off events, and the other suggesting evolutionary change in a Darwinian or variation thereof, nuance thereof, biological change.
Mm-hmm. And so the kind of the cash value of this is that we can categorically say that if an effect is caused by a per se cause, then it is not an evolutionary cause.
If I'm born with big ears, I genetically acquired that trait from my parents, That's a per accident causal chain. My parents can get old and die, and I'm not going to, my ears aren't going to get smaller. My mother has to be alive long enough for me to be born, I guess, but that's sort of beside the point. Once I'm born, you know, I'm born with big ears.
Yeah.
No one had to do anything other than give birth, right? So.
Yeah. The point in this distinction is about the relation of dependence between cause and effect. So
right.
There is a, there is space between in a per accidents cause. There is space between cause and effect. Whereas in a per se causal chain, there's no space. They're almost, when I think about these distinctions, or when I think about a per se causal chain, I think about something like the light from a candle, but the illumination of a room from a candle. When you put out the candle, you darken the room. They're very, very closely associated.
On the other hand, if you light a fire which burns down the building,
mm-hmm.
and the fire goes out, the building is still burned down.
Yeah, it doesn't just reconstruct itself once the fire goes out.
So, you know, in a rough way, that's analogous to biological change which is non-genetic versus biological change which is genetically transmitted intergenerationally.
Mm. Yeah.
I just want to acknowledge that, so I don't completely gloss it over and get criticized for this. There are other possible examples of intergenerational biological change which are not evolutionary. So kind of they fit into a gray area. An example of that would be something that's referred to as epigenetics. Epigenetics has been proposed as a mechanism for intergenerational biological change, which does not entail genetic mutation. So this is sort of a gray area type of change that straddles the fence here. So what epigenetics suggests is that, for example, there could be in utero exposure to maternal distress. So let's say that the mother is distressed in some way, either physically or emotionally. That can negatively affect the maturation, and I'll read here from my research, affect the maturation of prefrontal and subcortical neural circuits in the fetus. It's been proposed that a parent's childhood experience may indirectly affect the brains of the offspring. There you have an intergenerational change, which was not genetic. It was simply exposure to stress or distress. But it did affect the offspring, and sort of like genetic change, even if the mother were to disappear, the offspring may still have continued effects of that in utero distress. So I just wanted to point out that there's a gray area here where there could be examples of intergenerational change, which is not transmitted genetically, but could be transmitted in some other fashion.
So when you say it's not transmitted genetically, I understand how it is sort of, it's caused by a situation or something like that in this example. But my question would be whether it still has an impact on the genetic lineage, as it were. Like, I wonder if I'm just getting hung up on the name epigenetics, because my impression from that would be that, a situation occurs and epigenetic, let's just call it A happens to an offspring. Now, does that impact, and if they, let's say they go on to have kids, does A, which is contained in their genes now, can that be passed on genetically? Because if that is, it seems to be an introduction into the evolutionary chain, and in some, I guess that's
possible.
Yeah. So maybe that's it's gray.
Yeah, I'm sure there are, you can think of it, there's researchers trying to show that somewhere. But I don't need to go down that rabbit hole. All I'm saying is, without making any claim or suggestion of genetic change, that a fetus in utero could be impacted by distress impact on the mother, and that will then affect the development, will affect the brain and the development of that offspring without making any claim about it altering genes. In fact, I want to specifically say that or suggest that it did not alter genes, that there was no genetic change. It was simply distress caused a physical change, which was acquired by the subsequent generation. I just am pointing that out, this example, to show that I understand the nuances and this is not black and white. There can be intergenerational change that's not genetic. I just want to avoid making a too strong of a claim that all intergenerational change is genetic, whereas non-intergenerational change is not genetic. So there can be intergenerational change, which is not genetic. And not only is it not genetic, but it's per accident. The new child once born will have automatically acquired the effects of the previous cause without having a requirement that the previous cause continue to exist. So I just wanted to acknowledge that there is some gray area, but I stand by the most significant distinction, which is that, one more time, evolutionary change by genetic mutation, however that occurs, is specifically associated with per accidents causal chain. If there's not a per accidents causal chain, then it's not genetic mutation. It's not evolution. Per accidents causal chain is required, in my argument, for there to be evolution. If it were not a per accidents causal chain, it would not be evolution. It would be something different. It would be, you know, impact of, you know, ad hoc impact from events or impact from ad hoc events, which needed to be repeated or to happen in order for the change to occur. Very different from the per accidents causal chain of evolution, biological evolution. So you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Kaditz. I'm here with Brandon Brownlee, and I'm giving a talk about my theory that cultural evolution actually does not exist. So let me move on. I've been talking about biological evolution. So what about cultural evolution? Cultural evolution, in a very general sense, is the claim that cultures evolve. It seems somewhat self-evident that cultures do. I mean, we can think of examples of so many examples, right, of where cultures change over time. Things that were not acceptable become acceptable. Values change. People have different beliefs than they did 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 1,000 years ago. Indeed, contained within my argument is an example of cultural change. I'm not going to concede that it's evolution. That's going to be my point, that it's not. But I'm talking about per se and per accidents causal chains, which, as far as I know, I can't find anywhere in the current literature where those terms are used, but certainly in medieval philosophy.
I know that when I learned this distinction, I learned it as the distinction between immanent and transcendental, transcendent causality. So that might be right. Other terms you would look at too.
Mm-hmm. Even under those labels, I think it's largely a discussion that's found with respect to medieval or perhaps even classical philosophy, Aristotle, that kind of thing, talking about the types Aristotle discussed causal chains. You know, but in many ways, the medieval philosophers like St. Thomas Aquinas were, their views, their models, their theories were heavily affected by Aristotle.
Yeah.
But philosophy has evolved, right? They say, they claim culture has evolved, but has it. So let's recall that the way we can distinguish between evolutionary and non-evolutionary change in the biological world is the type of causal chain that takes place. Cultural evolution.